This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. Our guest today is Bodhanatha Velanswami, who is here to help get a new Hindu temple started in Champaign-Urbana. Welcome, Swami.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
And you've come from where?
We've come from Hawaii.
Which part of Hawaii? I know there are several islands over there.
Well, we're on one of the smaller ones, which is the island of Kauai.
And there's a Hindu monastery there.
Yes, we have a monastery there. It's been there since 1970, and we have some 22 monastics in residence at this time.
Now, some people may know of monasteries from other traditions better than they know about monasteries from the Hindu tradition. Are your monasteries single gender, one sex, or are they mixed?
Well, this monastery is single gender, and there are mixed, shall we say, institutions in Hinduism, and quite often those are called ashrams to distinguish them from a monastery. An ashram isn't necessarily co-ed, but it quite often in these days it is.
So it may be co-ed.
Uh-huh. But a monastery is either just men or just women in a separate tradition.
And again, a question that comes from people more familiar with other traditions. What kind of vows or promises do Hindu monks make in this case? Do you promise things like chastity and poverty and those sorts of things?
Or exactly. The same kinds of things as to monastics of other traditions. It's not really different in that regard.
Now, are you silent, or are there periods of silence and meditation? What is your life like on that monastery? In that monastery.
Well, it's not a monastery of silence. That's a certain kind of monastery, and certainly there are. There is some of that within the Hindu tradition, but this is more an active monastery, a monastery that's balancing personal worship and meditation, scriptural study, along with a active mission in the Hindu world. So we combine both things in our daily routines.
What kind of actions are you involved in?
Well, we're involved in a couple of different kinds of actions. One is just our monastery is also a place of pilgrimage. In the Hindu tradition, not only do you have local temples, hopefully nearby where you live, where you can go, say, once a week, but you're encouraged to pilgrimage once a year if you can, or less often, to a major temple at some distance and spend a week or two involved in pilgrimage. So traditionally, many Hindus have pilgrimaged to India, and we're providing an alternative to going all the way to India in Hawaii. So every day we have a number of Hindu families drop in for worship and to enjoy our property. The monastery side is some 51 acres, and then we have an additional 407, which is agricultural. So on the 47, we have temples and shrines and places to meditate, which the pilgrims can enjoy as well as the resident monastics. So that's one of the aspects of our mission, is providing a place of pilgrimage. And in that regard, we have two temples. One is finished since 1973. We have a traditional temple built in a Western-style building. But we're building a traditional Eastern-style temple in the old-fashioned way, which is out of granite. So it's hand-carved granite that's quarried and then carved in India, shipped to the USA, and being assembled there in Hawaii.
Wow.
So it's a traditional all-granite hand-carved temple that we've been carving since 1990. So we've been carving it for 18 years, and we've been assembling it in Hawaii for 6 years, so this is all done by traditional Indian temple craftsmen called Silpis. So it's quite a unique temple, and when it's finished, we'll offer a really outstanding focal point for the pilgrimage experience. It's an indoor-outdoor temple, which you can do in Hawaii in the traditional Indian style. It's warm enough so you don't have to close it in, nor do you have to have any heating or ventilation. So it's just open to the elements, which is a nice feature of a Hindu temple, kind of blesses the surrounding area with its ceremonies. So I'd say the second part of our mission is mainly publications. These are originally just printed publications, but more recently we've developed an extensive website. So lots of our material, including many of our books, are available online. And even more recently, we've, in order to appeal to younger people in particular, we're putting our material on YouTube in video form and striving to do more of that and develop more of the latest technology in terms of blogs and other uses of the internet to make the material interesting to younger people.
So here is a ancient religion which carries on many traditional activities and yet is as modern as YouTube.
Well, yes. You know, in fact, that you might say that contradiction or unusual juxtaposition has struck many people who, you know, come to the temple and worship and all, and then they come over to our publication department and there it is with, you know, the latest in Macintosh computers and large screens and everything. And you know, they enjoy it, but they're somewhat initially surprised that we're so modern in our technology and also able to be traditional in our temples and other practices at the same time.
I want to ask more questions about the temples in Hawaii where you worship and at your monastery. And, of course, the temple here in Champaign-Urbana that you're here to help get the fundraising started for the temple that would be in North Champaign. And I want to talk about pilgrimage a bit more, but let me just take one moment to tell listeners that this program is a little bit unusual for Keeping the Faith. Usually, as you know, we are live and people can call in with comments or questions. But because of the Swami's very busy travel schedule, we're needing to record this previously. And so please do not call, do not try to call during this hour. I'm sorry you can't ask live questions, but I'll do the best I can to ask the kind of questions I think you might ask. So we're very happy to be able to interview our guest during the very short time that he's here. And I might just say, Swami, you are here in the middle of the United States after having been in San Francisco on your way to Canada, Toronto, right?
Yes, that's right, Steve. We on Memorial Day weekend, we had a 2.5-day retreat program with classes, some meditations, some ceremonies in the Santa Cruz Mountains outside of California. And then this next weekend, we're participating in some special temple ceremonies and giving some talks in Toronto, Canada. There's a very large Hindu population in Toronto these days.
Now, people may be surprised at how large the Hindu population is in the various United States. Mm-hmm. How many in Hawaii might there be?
Well, in Hawaii, there's very few Hindus. The statistic given for the USA, I think, is 2.9 million is one number that I ran across yesterday. It's a little hard to measure because of the fluctuations. Many Hindus are here, say, in the IT industry just for a few years.
Yes.
And aren't citizens. So.
Or might be here for graduate school or,
exactly.
Or college.
Exactly. So it's a little hard to count, and numbers do vary. It's always over 2 million. In Hawaii, it's a small Hindu population. We're not there because it's a Hindu center. We're there more because it's a beautiful, secluded place where Hindus can go and enjoy the serenity of Hinduism in a contemplative atmosphere rather than in the middle of a big city. It's also a good place for a monastery, you know, being somewhat out in the country, rural areas, typical to not have monasteries downtown.
Yes.
In Chicago or something. So most of the Hindus in Hawaii are on the island of Oahu, which is where Honolulu is, and quite a few of them affiliate with the university and the East-West Center, and even those Hindus don't stay that long, just there for projects.
Now, there's been a tremendous growth in the number of Hindus in the United States over the past, what, 20 years?
Well, let's see, 1970, so 20, you know, I'd say 20 to 30 years is a good measure, or even up to 35 years has been the most recent influx.
And part of that is due to immigration.
Well, yes. The immigration laws are such in the United States that only the high-end professionals in the Hindu community really are the ones that come here.
Yes.
So it gives a distorted demographic versus, you know, Hindus in, say, India, for example.
Of course.
So you get all professionals here. Originally, it was mainly doctors. For some reason, there are lots of doctors. Hindu doctors came to the U.S., and more recently, it's in the IT industry.
Yes.
And then the children of the older immigrants are in all kinds of fields.
Of course. Now, you've had also many people who have chosen to become Hindu. Tell us a little bit about that. What's that process like in Hinduism?
Well, it's a process that is taking place in a number of countries outside of India, and usually relates to some religious leader. Religious leaders in Hinduism, there's many kinds. The most common kind are called swamis, which are basically monks who teach. You know, simple definition of a swami. So, in many instances, they have developed a group of followers, and the followers are so sincere in their pursuit of Hinduism that they have brought them into the religion. So that's the most common way that that happens.
Now, there's another title or honorific that's sometimes used, which is guru or satguru.
Yes. Well, guru just means teacher. That's why the word sat is there. So a music teacher, a math teacher, anyone could be called a guru. It's just a title of respect. When you add sat, sat means truth, so a teacher of truth. So the satguru is someone who talks about God or is teaching purely religion, whereas other gurus could be teaching dance or singing or something like that.
I see. All right. Let me reintroduce our guest for listeners who may have joined us in the middle of the program. We're talking with Bodhinatha Velanswami, who is in Champaign-Urbana to help inaugurate the fundraising for a new Hindu temple, the first Hindu temple building that's been here in Champaign-Urbana, and in fact, I guess, in downstate Illinois, although there are Hindu temples in the Chicago area, of course, and I suspect St. Louis and Indianapolis. This program is heard in all those areas, so I mentioned that.
There's
those.
One in Peoria.
Peoria as well.
I don't know how close that is.
Okay,
yes.
Well, it's about as far north as Chicago, slightly west. Mm-hmm. But we might talk about that just for a few minutes. You're here to help begin this, and you'll have some sort of ceremonies, give a talk. What will happen?
Yes, there's a scheduled tonight is an event which the devotees of the temple have been invited to, and I think a certain number of RSVP'd. And so it's a gathering in a hotel which will explain the temple concept, you know, show drawings and the building that's planned and explain the history and and the fundraising goals, and then invite me to speak on kind of the inner significance of Hindu temple worship. And so it's introducing the program. It's not a major fundraising event, but rather introduction, low-key fundraising event combined with some philosophy about the temple.
All right, some education as well.
Yes.
All right. Since this program will be broadcast after that event, give us, for those who may have missed it, just a short synopsis of what some of the things you might cover this evening when you talk about the significance of a Hindu temple here in the Midwest.
Well, perhaps I could just use that opportunity to say a few general things before jumping into the temple.
Sure.
Because one of the, what would you say, one of the challenges that Hinduism faces in North America, both in USA and Canada, is that there's a number of misconceptions.
You know,
because it's a religion that hasn't been here that long, and it's not similar to, say, Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, which are better understood.
Yes. You know,
it's an Eastern religion. So one of the aspects of it that's misunderstood is that, well, Hinduism believes in many gods. You know, it's a pluralistic religion. So meaning many gods without any of them being supreme. So, and that confusion carries over to the Hindu temple when individuals visit a Hindu temple and they see shrines for many gods and without any philosophical understanding, that's an easy conclusion to draw. But the key idea in Hinduism is that there are many traditions and each of the traditions believes in a supreme being. So, you know, that's a very important point because it's often misunderstood by those of other religions. So there's even a famous statement from the scriptures that says, in English, says, truth is one, sages describe it variously. That's the key statement. And we always believe that in a situation such as this program where the audience isn't that knowledgeable in Hinduism, that it's useful to get that concept in, you know, one place or another. So I thought I could slip it in
of
right
course,
here.
Of course, that's very appropriate.
Before we talk about
so
it.
So as you say, people who would visit a Hindu temple would see representations of various deities and might assume, oh, well, a person who comes here must believe in all of them. But you're saying, no, within Hinduism, there's mm-hmm. room for people who worship one supreme being
right.
and can come to the temple to worship that being.
Well, yes. And so Hinduism has four main denominations, and we won't go into it. But the basic idea is it has quite distinct approaches within one religion, which is unusual. So I like to say that the supreme being has many names and many concepts, and the name or concept isn't common to all Hindus. So one Hindu will say God has this name and concept, and another will say, to me, God has this name and concept. And so there's quite a variety, and sometimes you'll find the multiple concepts in one temple in the USA because Hindus can only, so few Hindus, they can't build 5 or 10 temples, one
of
to
course.
Each concept. You know, so you find an unusual number of concepts in one building. So therefore, it's useful to know that to the Hindus going there, one of those deities is the supreme being, but it's not the same one to each person going.
Right.
So there's a diversity. So back to your question, which is, you know, what kinds of points will I be making about the Hindu temple? Well, Hinduism is what I call an experiential religion, meaning it's focusing on experiencing God in one way or another while we're here on earth. It's not a religion that believes you have to wait till you pass on and go to heaven and then you get to meet God. You know, God is, experience, we're able to experience God on earth if we have some knowledge as to how to do so. So that's the Hindu idea. So I call that experiential.
And with the idea of reincarnation, that might happen more than once.
Well, absolutely. You know, that's a very good point, is that over a period of many lives, the Hindu belief is we come closer to God. We get to know God. And our desire to know God eventually increases, or our curiosity, shall I say. You know, we just want to know more. It becomes more important to us at a certain point in our reincarnation process. So that's basically a Hindu idea, the idea of reincarnation and experience of God, they tie together. Many ideas in Hinduism require a belief in reincarnation to understand them. Even the idea of karma, for example, you know, it when you hear the word karma, almost within a sentence or two, you'll hear the word reincarnation also, because the two concepts go well together. But not to digress too far here. So the idea is that in the temple, it's one way of one place where Hindus can experience God. That's why they go to the temple, and the ceremonies that are done there by well-qualified priests and all kind of make that possible. And so without going into detail, that's what the talk tonight would look at. You know, well, how is it exactly, in what different ways can Hindus experience God at the temple?
Now, you mentioned earlier that a monk in a Hindu monastery is celibate, unmarried.
Mm-hmm.
May Hindu priests marry?
Hindu priests almost always marry. And in fact, I don't know if it's true in all lineages, but certainly in the lineages I know, to be a senior priest, you have to be married. It's actually required.
Now, may only males be priests or may females be priests?
In most situations, only males can be priests. Let me clarify that. In what we would call a public temple, a temple where, you know, there's no, it's just standing alone as a temple where Hindus in the area go, almost always it would just be men that can be priests. In what I would call a private temple, a temple, say, in an ashram or in a monastery of women, women could be priests. So in certain situations, you do find women as priests. But not in what we would call the public or the most common temple.
Okay. And
women can be swamis. There's no restriction on that.
You know, they could be a monk who could teach.
They could be a monk who could teach and be a woman. In fact, you know, in our opinion, Hinduism has more religious leaders who were women than any other religion, and this was evidenced at year 2000, the United Nations had a gathering of religious and spiritual summit of Millennium Summit of religious and spiritual leaders, drawing religious leaders from all the major faiths together at the United Nations for a couple of days, trying to see if they could be pointed more toward implementing world peace.
Yes,
in the world.
Understanding and peace.
Yes.
Right.
So. My guru, who passed on in 2001, shortly after that event, was there as a speaker, and one of his comments was that, you know, by far Hinduism had the most women as spiritual leaders.
Really?
Yeah. So it's a common aspect of Hinduism. Some of the most popular religious leaders in Hinduism are women, but in some areas, like in temples, you know, they're not traditionally. They don't traditionally serve in that capacity.
Right. Tell us a little bit more about what happens in a typical temple that's a public temple, as you say, like the one that will be built here in Champaignermana relatively soon. As you've heard, there was some controversy among some of the neighbors who were a little bit worried about too much activity or activity they didn't understand that would be in this temple. What will happen there?
Well, in the USA, Hindu temples are pretty much, in the terms of attendance, like other religious places of worship, that people come on the weekend, primarily on Sunday. So it's the same. You know, the crowds will come on Sunday. It's also like a Catholic church. You know, Catholic churches have Mass every day.
Yes.
But not very many people go necessarily.
Of course. Yeah, right. So that's possible in the Hindu temple as well.
So Hindu temples usually have ceremonies every day, but not very many people come. In fact, no one may come on a snowy winter day.
Sure. Know,
but it's looked at as part of perpetuating the sanctity of the temple to have a daily service. So in terms of what a typical service is called a puja, P-U-J-A, and involves chanting, usually in the Sanskrit language, and making offerings to the deity of flowers, cut fruit, incense, lamps, and sometimes certain bathing ceremonies are done for certain of the deities where you use not only water but milk, yogurt, sandalwood paste, and other substances, all for the purpose of invoking God's presence through the image. That's the basic idea of the ceremony.
Now, in a culture that you, such as you find here in North America, where Christianity, particularly Protestant Christianity, was very strong here for so long, and now, of course, the Catholic Church is very well represented throughout this part of the country as well as others, and Judaism has been represented here for a long time. Islam has come to attention and growth much more in the last 20 or 30 years, like Hinduism. But where you have some of these other traditions where, for example, in Judaism, you're not to make a representation of the deity. Mm-hmm. There's not to be any statues or paintings or photographs of of God. The kind of symbolism that's in a Hindu temple may be seen by some as unusual or even shocking.
Well, absolutely, Steve. This is a challenge to explain, and you know, sometimes the question is put more directly. You know,
are these idols?
Yes, exactly. do Hindus believe in idolatry? Are they idol worshippers? So, you know, I have two answers for that. I had the experience of being at a temple in Toronto, from the Caribbean, most of the devotees, and they were installing a deity there. And one of the local cable television channels, you know, small audience, just cable channels, sent out a lady, Protestant lady, to interview me. And so she went through the temple, and then we went down to the basement afterwards, and you could tell that she was not used to 20 or 30 different idols staring her in the face with unusual symbolism. So, you know, we were getting ready for the interview, and I was trying to loosen her up because she was obviously a little tense. And so I said, sometimes Hindus are called idol worshippers. But I said, you can see from all the energy expressed by these devotees that they're not lazy at all in their worship. So that got a little smile there.
Yes, right on.
Yes, so. But then I went on to explain that try and draw a comparison to photographs of family so that, you know, for example, it's very common practice in Western culture that those who are married have photographs of their spouse and children in their wallet. They have photographs on their desk at work, photographs even in their bedroom at home, even though the family's there, right? Photographs all over the place. So, you know, I say, does that make them photograph worshipers, you know?
Sure.
And, of course, the answer is no. No, their photographs remind them of real people. And the photographs are looked at as a useful tool to remind you and make you feel closer to the people you love. So pictures or statues in the Hindu tradition are the same. In this case, the being is in heaven, shall we say, that is being loved. And the picture or the statue helps us feel closer to that being in the same way that photographs work for a family.
And part of this, I think, is a difference between East and West often. Mm-hmm. Eastern Christianity, for example, often uses icons or pictures or paintings as a way to celebrate the Jesus or the saints.
Well, you're right. That's a very good point. So, in the Eastern Christian tradition, they are used much more so than some others.
Now, another difference that people may notice in this country around a Hindu temple is the dress of some of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Things that may be on their forehead, marks
yes.
that might be on their body.
Right.
For example, tell us about your dress. You're wearing a robe. Is this what color would you say this is?
Well, it's some form of orange. Depends on the particular dye lot. We know we dye our own, so it doesn't always come out the same. But orange is a color for swamis. So it doesn't have to be robes. It could just be pants and shirt if, you know, for exercise or something. But traditionally, swamis wear orange, and another traditional color is white. White is worn by those striving to become a swami. Huh. White is also worn, say, by widows or widowers. So white has a certain sense of purity or speciality to it. Other colors don't relate to a specific status. The robes themselves aren't restricted to monks. In India, it's an old-fashioned form of dress, which is, as is the case in, you know, most countries like Japan, you know, how many men do you find in old-fashioned dress? You know, they're all wearing European suits.
Sure.
So there's a trend in the world to give up traditional dress for European dress. The women are more prone to wear traditional dress in many countries than, say, the men. So the same in Hinduism. These are with or without shirt is traditional form of dress, these kinds of robes, which is called a dhoti is one of the names, or veshti. And then, of course, women, most common form of dress for women is the traditional sari, which even popular, you know, in some fashion circles in the West, the sari is such a
And tell unusual. Us about the mark on the forehead of many Hindus.
Well, Hindus? Well, again, it's the same idea of traditional dress. I'd say in the old days, you know, all Hindus wore a dot right in the center of the forehead, right in the brow area, and that. The colors would differ, but women in modern times, women are more prone to wear one than men in sense of carrying on tradition. So it's a symbol of the spiritual eye. In mysticism, Hindu mysticism, the idea is we not only have two physical eyes, we have a third eye, which is a spiritual eye, and it's our spiritual eye that can see into the heavenly realms. And actually see the gods, see God and the gods, see great saints. You know, you can actually have visions, and you're doing that not with your physical eyes, but with your spiritual eye. So the presence of a dot reminds us to look into those realms and not to get totally enthralled with the material world, which every 10 years gets more and more fascinating with computer technology and other things, you know.
Well, now, One of the parts of my religious tradition, I come from a Christian tradition, is Puritanism, where some of my ancestors who came to this country several centuries ago felt that the variety of Christianity they were objecting to had gotten too elaborate and too focused on the material, among other things. And so they wouldn't wear jewelry, they wouldn't wear makeup, their dress was very plain, their homes were very simple, their churches were very simple, stripped of ornamentation, you know, all of that. So there's that particular strain in parts of American Christianity. In Hinduism, for example, although you say the spiritual eye helps one get beyond the material, seems very elaborate. I mean, you're wearing what looks like a beautiful gold necklace and earrings and bracelets. And this is often found with Hindus. What does it mean for a Hindu to wear jewelry?
Well, we need to distinguish between the majority of Hindus who are married or plan to get married. You know, we call that following the family path.
Okay.
And those who are following the monastic path.
Ah.
So sometimes the two get lumped together and confusion occurs because they're not following the same principles. You know, it's like the principles of a cloistered monk and Catholicism versus the principles of, some other family.
Of course. So, very different.
Very different. So Hinduism has two approaches as well. Though those are fancy items that I'm wearing, if you were to look in my wardrobe, you know, there's about three sets of robes and one set of shoes, There's no Mercedes outside, There's a few items that are that go with the office, you know, being the head of the monastery. It's like the Pope, for example, has a lot more fancy items than anyone else in the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And I'm not sure, if...
So they're symbols of the office in some case.
They transfer with the office. They're not personal property.
Really?
Yes. It's like this was given to me. Well, both of these were given to me by the previous head who passed on in 2001. So he was wearing these.
A bracelet and a
necklace.
What do you call it? A necklace?
Necklace, yes. A necklace is
quite
fine.
Beautiful, yes.
Yes. So those are part of the office. And
so the
otherwise,
next head of the monastery, you would pass them on
to. But the monks in general have very little in terms of personal possessions. They don't have a lot of clothes or don't have any money so forth. So possessions are very simple for monks.
Okay.
And for family people, they're encouraged to become wealthy. Wealth is looked at as a goal of life, a legitimate goal of life in Hinduism that everyone should pursue as much as is they're capable of, and not only for themselves, but so they can be charitable.
I see.
You know, so they can support Hindu temples, support hospitals, universities, and so forth, with wealth that is they can afford to give away. So wealth is both to support the family and to give away in various charitable activities, and it's looked at as what would you say, auspicious or. Attractive to abundance for women to have lots of gold.
It is, okay.
Yeah, it's a good thing. It helps the family be prosperous for the women to wear gold. So they'll have a gold wedding band and gold jewelry and so forth. And
the Hindu wedding ceremonies are quite wonderful.
Well, yes. Definitely very elaborate and a good combination of ceremony and vows and family gathering and so forth, all combined together.
Let me take another moment just to reintroduce our guest and explain why we are not accepting phone calls today. We're pre-recording this. We have pre-recorded this program to be broadcast at this time in order to fit the very tight schedule of our guest, who is the head of a monastery in Hawaii, a Hindu monastery. And he has several titles, Satguru, is one of his titles. His name is Bodhinatha Vailan Swami, and Swami is part of the last name and also a part of the title that indicates that he is a monk in this monastery who also teaches. So he has administrative responsibilities. He may have fundraising responsibilities. I don't know. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he also has teaching responsibilities as well. So he is here to help celebrate the beginning of the fundraising for the Hindu temple, which will be built here in Champaign-Urbana, the only one south of Peoria and Chicago in the state, we believe. And it's quite exciting to the local Hindu community to be able to have land that they've purchased, I believe 40 acres, because Hindus celebrate nature and want their temples to be in a place where they could enjoy nature. And the building will be constructed in North Champaign beginning very soon, we believe. So welcome to our guest again, but I'm sorry, because of the pre-recording of this, we cannot accept phone calls during this hour. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and I am the executive director of the University YMCA. The Y is the oldest of the religious institutions here at this university. It's been here 136 years, and It began as a Christian organization, but has been open to people of any faith or of no particular religious tradition to be involved in our tutoring programs and our social action programs, community service programs, and many students participate in those regardless of what their motives may be. We're happy to have them serving others through the Y and getting the help of our program directors and our experience and history on this campus. We have tried at the Y to be open to people of many different faiths who are interested in serving others. So we're happy to join hands with Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Christians of any sort. So I'm pleased to be associated with such an organization for about only another month or two. I'm retiring at the end of August, and we have an interim director, a former associate dean of students here at the university, Willard Broom, who will be our director of the Y while they continue to search for a permanent executive director. One of the big Y programs is Dump and Run, and this August, the first week of school, we'll be having our big sale of items collected over the summer that we're recycling and helping new students and others get new use for. And so that will be happening in the fall. Watch for announcements here on Keeping the Faith and elsewhere in the community about our big sale. You can find many great items inexpensively, and if you still would like to donate, there'll be a time in early August. You can still bring things to the University Stock Pavilion for our big sale. So if you'd like to donate items or come and purchase other items, keep your eye out for Dump and Run. It's an odd title, Swami, but it's a grand project.
Sounds very practical.
It is. And we have students, particularly from other countries, who come here with just a couple suitcases, and they have to start classes in a week.
Oh,
and
my.
They really need to furnish a room or an apartment, and so this is one way to do that very cheaply.
I see.
It's nice.
Furnishings.
But back to our discussion about the new temple here and what it's like to worship in a temple. You talked a little bit about the two paths, the monastic path and the family path for Hindus. What is it like for those who – it's a minority, of course, who choose the monastic path, who feel that that is the path for them. Mm-hmm. For the majority of devotees, they would be in the family path.
Mm-hmm.
What are the, I guess, important events in their lives that happen at a temple? Weddings might be one.
Important events in the lives of the family,
the
those
family,
following the
yes.
family path, Steve. Okay. I'd say wedding is looked at as the most important ceremony of the many ceremonies that Hindus undergo. Ceremonies start after birth with a naming ceremony, just as in other religions, and continue through childhood with such ceremonies as first feeding, beginning of learning, some ceremony in the teens to acknowledge coming of age is typical. Sometimes a ceremony to acknowledge study of the most ancient scriptures, which are called the Vedas. Sometimes there's a ceremony just for that if you're studying it in a serious way. And then marriage would be the next one. Age 60 is like a renewal ceremony that is kind of strengthening you for the rest of your life.
What a nice term for that at age 60. Yeah.
Those are the main ones that come to mind.
What happens at a renewal ceremony at age 60? I'd love to hear. I missed it just a few years back.
Okay. Well, traditionally it's for the man primarily, and so he gets to be the deity. He gets to have water poured over him, and certain priests do chants and all. So you need a warm climate for that one. Or do it in the summer.
Or get real dried off before you go outside in Illinois in the winter.
Right, and then the wife participates also, but she's not doesn't go through the abhishekam.
Uh-huh. All right. What about weekly ceremonies or weekly worship in a temple for people, Hindus, following the family path?
Well, in Hinduism, there's no Sabbath. You know, there's no one day out of seven that is looked at by all Hindus as the holy day, and the other six are looked at as not the holy day. But on a practical scale, Hindus tend to go to a temple once a week. But in India, the days vary. Some most popular days are Monday and Friday in India.
Oh.
But that's when travel is shorter. And in the U.S., because travel times are long and you work late, again, most people only go to the temple on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. So Hindus do go to the temple once a week, but there's no one day that's a Sabbath day. And in fact, we encourage the other look at it, that all days are sacred. You know, that in fact, many Hindus do a little ceremony in the home. They have a little shrine in the home and spend anywhere from 2 minutes up to a couple of hours doing the same type of ceremony, which is the puja in the home, and that's done on a daily basis. We also try and encourage Hindus to not divide life into sacred and secular, but to look at wherever they are, you know, be it at school, at work, out in the community, elsewhere, as an opportunity to be of service to others and to make some spiritual progress by doing things to help others and act in certain ways.
Now, do Hindus typically have organizations to help Hindus who want to be of service to others do that, or is it independent?
I'd say it's usually done through organizations. Temples in the U.S. Are the main organization, and the ones that have been established for a while do have community drives, just like other religious groups, helping the food bank and in terms of relief efforts and so forth. They have drives and activities to reach out.
Now, tell me, how does one become a monk?
Well, monk and swami are slightly different. One could, I'd say, become a monk just on his own.
Okay.
Hinduism is not that structured. You know, it's not like there's a one hierarchy that governs everything. There's lots of independent hierarchies and lots of independent action all under the banner of Hinduism. But to become a swami, you need to be initiated as a swami by another swami. It's that simple. So if you can find a swami to make you a swami, he may do it after a week's study. He may ask you to study for 10 years. There's no one system. And in our tradition, you study typically from 6 to 12 years before you become a swami.
And did you do that?
Yes.
You mentioned that your guru had died fairly recently.
2001, yes.
Right. How did you find that guru?
Well, a long time ago, Steve. This was back 1964 in California. I found him in the San Francisco area. We had a center in the city of San Francisco and had some occasionally appeared in the religious column of the San Francisco Chronicle. So I happened to find it. And
did you grow up in a Hindu family?
No.
You did not?
No. The family I grew up in had really no practicing religion, as is the case in many homes in North America. Maybe the grandparents were practicing Christians, but the parents are more often secular humanists, shall we say. That's the newest, more form of religion. They kind of believe something, but they never practice anything.
Sure.
They're trying to help other people.
Right.
So that was the kind of family I grew up in. And so that happened back in 1964. And previous to that, I'd been visiting some of the— there weren't any Hindu temples in the USA at that time, so they had some Hindu centers like the Vedanta Society. There's one in Chicago that's one of the oldest, and one in St. Louis. There were some of those in California that I would visit, and other couple of other groups, but very sparse. Very sparse back then.
Sure.
Compared to now.
So you really had to be active yourself in those years to find someone to study with.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, you had
to. So were you in college at the time or high school?
College.
College,
yes.
Okay.
College. Just finishing college.
So you found this guru and he set up a course of study for you? Practice?
Well, yes. I'd say that's what happened initially, and then after about a year, I moved into the monastery.
Okay.
And then that started living a monastic life as a beginning monastic.
Now, when one chooses the monastic life and chooses to not follow a family path, you give up the idea of marriage, of sexual relations. Is that a requirement or is that a choice or both?
Oh, it's a requirement.
Requirement.
In Hindu monasticism.
So why would a young person, a young man in California in the 60s, choose a path other than the sexuality that was everywhere and that sort of a life?
Well, it's in my case, it was an interest in experiencing God, I'd say. That was more important than experiencing other things.
Okay.
So...
And what was your idea of God?
Well, it came from the Vedanta explanations of God as like an omnipresent consciousness, as well as some personal form. It wasn't that clear to me at the time. But, you know, I'd been reading about it for years, and that's what the book's generally focused on.
Oh. And as you now are older and more experienced and look back on your life, do you encourage others to follow this path?
Well, I'd say yes. In our case, I'll give you a sense of what we do. You know, we don't just sign people up easily. If someone in, say, USA, or could be anywhere, but USA is easier because there's no visas required to get here, which can complicate things. Someone in the USA is interested in monastic life, and say we require their at least a high school graduate.
Yes.
So they'd normally be at least 18. We have them come and stay in the monastery in a guest house for 6 months and try it out.
Okay.
This is after screening them to make sure they seem like it could work out and there's no...
Psychologically.
Yeah, there's no strangeness or something. They seem very solid and know what they're doing, and parents are supportive of their coming for 6 months at least. And then we have them go home and think about it and see, did they really like it? So... And that way we encourage everyone, but, you know, with checks and balances along the way to make sure it's working out for them. And, you know, they're not choosing us because their parents just got divorced and they need a new home.
Sure.
You know, that there's really a strong spiritual motivation there that's been there for a while.
What are the rules of monastic life for a Hindu?
Well, there's two basic approaches. One is when you live together and follow a common routine, and the other is less strict, where you, particularly in India, you tend to wander more on your own and come together for just part of the year. So we follow the monastery group routine. So, for example, in our monastery... you know, we have from 5:30 to 7:15 every morning is the group. We worship in the temple with the traditional puja, and then we spend about an hour in meditation afterwards, and then go about our daily chores and mission work.
What are some of those chores?
Well, we have to take care of our own place.
Okay.
You know, we don't have any...
No servants.
No servants, no housekeepers, no maids. So it's a big place, so we have to just keep it functioning.
And do you do something to create income? Do you produce things? Like sometimes in Catholic monasteries, mm-hmm. for example, here in this country or around the world, they'd have some... something they would produce. It might be bread. It might be who knows what. Mm-hmm. But
no, we don't do that.
No covers.
No, what we produce are the publications, and we're not trying to make a profit on them to do something else with. You know, the money of the publications. We have a magazine. We produce books.
So, are you supported by donations?
We're supported
from other
by donations. Yes,
okay.
And we. The closer someone is to us, the more they're likely to donate. So we have study programs, and we initiate individuals into certain traditional practices and bring them into a form of membership. So from just general public through being like a devotee or, you know, well-wisher into being a student, being a member, an initiated member, different degrees of closeness. So the closer they are, the more likely they are to be donating in a substantial way.
I see. Excuse me. And can someone leave a monastery at any time if they choose? Do they have that kind of freedom?
Well, in ours they do, yes,
okay.
Definitely.
And does that mean leaving permanently? If someone decides this life is not for me any longer, I'm going back into mainline society or follow the family path. Is that possible or not?
Oh, yes, of course.
It is.
It happens all the time.
Okay.
Yes.
So it doesn't necessarily have to be a once-for-life decision.
No, but ideally for someone who becomes a swami, it's supposed to be.
It is,
but
okay.
Up before that point, which can take many, many years, it's not. Permanent.
I see. We're down to our last minute or so. Let's just remind people that during this interview, we've not received phone calls because we've pre-recorded this to fit with the schedule of our guest today, who is Satguru Bodhinatha Velanswami, the head of a monastery in Hawaii for Hindu monks. And he is in Champaign, Urbana to help celebrate the beginning of the fundraising project for a new temple here in Champaign, Urbana. The Swami will be giving a talk this evening. We're recording this on the 29th of May. And for those who may have missed it, he's been talking a little bit about some of the things he'll be saying tonight so that radio listeners around this part of the Midwest, we'll know more about the Hindu temple that will be here in Champaign-Urbana. I want to thank the Swami for taking time on his visit to be with us here on Keeping the Faith, and encourage listeners to tune in again next week when you will be able to call in. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
George Orwell wrote 1984 in response to fascism and communism. Does his story of Big Brother and Doublethink still matter today? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk with actor Tim Robbins about his theatrical adaptation of 1984, set in our own time. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana. Monday morning on Focus 580, we'll look back to one of the most significant moments in modern history. It took place in February of 1972 when Richard Nixon, the first American president ever to visit China, sat down with that country's leader, Mao Zedong. The visit only lasted an hour, but it laid the groundwork for the complex relationship we see today between China and the U.S. On Monday, we'll go to the archives for a conversation with Margaret McMillan, author of Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World. I'm David Inge, Focus 580, Monday morning at 10, here on WILL Urbana.